Zhang Qing, the widow of Mao Zedong, had been locked away in solitary confinement for 10 years. Over that time, she had hoarded socks and handkerchiefs until she had enough to make a rope. And in 1991, she hanged herself. She left a note. It said, "Today, the revolution has been stolen by a clique led by Deng Xiaoping. The result is that unending evils have been unleashed on the Chinese people. Chairman, your student and fighter, is coming to see you." Zhang Qing's great enemy, Deng Xiaoping, was now all-powerful. The new China he had created was growing rapidly, building vast factories to send goods to the West. He had got rid of all Zhang Qing's revolutionary dreams, but he had also smashed all visions of democracy by sending troops into Tiananmen Square. But Tiananmen Square had been a disaster for the regime, and it also raised a terrible question. If China no longer believed in revolutionary communism or in democracy, what did it believe in, apart from money? Deng Xiaoping's solution was to go back into the past and reawaken an old, powerful fear that what had happened in Tiananmen Square had really been part of a giant conspiracy by the West to destroy China. It was a conspiracy, he said, that had been going on for 150 years. It had begun back in the 19th century, when the British had invaded China and forced opium onto the Chinese people. Deng now ordered a vast propaganda campaign to begin. Its aim was to spread the idea of a conspiracy. At the centre of the campaign was a multi-million dollar film, including British actors.
Feng Zhi! Xiu Yan!
It told the story of how the British had brought hundreds of tons of opium into the port of Canton, and how the Chinese had tried to stop them. But the British, led by Queen Victoria, were determined to smash their resistance and use the opium to reduce the Chinese people to zombies and so control the whole world.
Gentlemen, the fact is, whoever gets hold of China will have the entire East. The 19th century.
The Chinese propaganda even created an early computer game where you could fight against the British as they invaded.
Good morning, player number one. You wake up in the second best room in the Pink Hotel. You have survived the effects of the banquet, but you cannot move your left hand. There is a door on the east wall opposite your bed, and next to it is a picture of a naked devil in a mirror.
He looks terrible. Who is that?
It's you.
It's me. I look terrible. Where are my jeans?
In your body.
No, I mean my trousers.
Your trousers are on the chair against the south wall.
I get up, I go to the chair, I'll put on my pants and get out of here. Ow! Ow! What happened?
You knocked over the champagne bottle.
I'll pick up the bottle. I pick up the bottle. Why can't I pick up the bottle?
You cannot move your left hand.
I use my right hand. Is there anything left?
There is one drink left.
Good, save it.
Saved.
Okay, now give me my trousers. Ah, help! Help! Help!
There's a one-eyed snake in your trousers.
I hate snakes. Give him the champagne.
The snake is now drunk.
Ah, good. I'll hold on to it.
Saved.
What's that?
A muffled voice calling for help.
I'm coming! I put on my pants.
Saved.
I go to the door. Open door. With my right hand, and I step out.
Army! Hey, Army buddy! Hey, don't close the door! Oh, no! We're trapped out here, and the hotel's on fire!
Where's the Rain Queen?
Well, I traded her to the Dust Master.
For what, Flipper?
For this fine hump on my back. Meet Earl the Halfling.
Hiya, Bloodbag.
What are we going to do with a halfling in the Holocaust?
Watch it. I've got a really low level of predictability.
Ow! Ow!
kicked me, I'll kill it.
No, he carries a lunchworm with an important message for you.
Lunchworm, give message.
Oh, no. You have to give me something.
Okay, what have I got? Inventory.
Player one, inventory. Half a map of parade route. Glass key. Ghetto blaster. Checkered trousers. Schnockered snake. Souvenir snowball with skyline of bonus city.
I like that. I like all this stuff.
Give him the key.
I need all this stuff.
Give him the key.
Okay, lose key.
Here, boss.
Thanks, Earl. Lunchworm, give message.
You know, we really must have lunch sometime.
That's no message.
How about the sky bridge is falling?
Holy hogfish. Looks like game over.
Stand back.
One.
Not while I got a snake in my pants. I'm just going to whip it out. Tie a knot into it and lasso that flagpole.
Go for it.
Okay, hop on, number two.
No thanks, one. I've got a key.
Save me.
Get off my back.
One and a half leg. Two heavy. A snake breaks.
Suck air, white devil. We halflings fly.
The pink hotel burns down. Game over. You have only 450 points. You are not a top 10 scorer.
Now, the campaign said, the West were trying to do the same again. What the Chinese were alleging in their campaign was historically accurate. But what they didn't know was that the opium trade had also had powerful consequences inside Britain itself. It had started to undermine the self-confidence of the British Empire and introduce a dark and corrosive fear into the heart of British society. By the middle of the 19th century, those who ran Britain were already aware of the horrors created by the slave trade. For 200 years, the British had transported millions of Africans to become slaves in their colonies in the Caribbean and in the Americas. It had been one of the main forces behind the rise of the British Empire. Now they began to realize that they had also done something terrible to China. That by forcing opium onto the country, they had poisoned and corrupted millions of people. They hadn't enslaved them physically. They had enslaved their minds. And in return, Britain had received a vast wave of money, in silver, that made it the richest and most powerful country in the world. One historian wrote, "Deeply involved as it was in one of the most pernicious, yet well-organized and profitable drug trades that has ever existed, the British Empire was rotten at its heart." And that knowledge led to guilt. In the 1870s, a mass movement was formed. It was called the Society for the Suppression of the Opium Trade. It published pamphlets and books about the horrors that were happening in China. They caused a sensation, and hundreds of thousands joined the movement. But as the campaign grew, a strange thing happened. The guilt over what Britain had done to China began to mutate. It changed into fear. And at the end of the 19th century, a hysteria swept Britain that the Chinese were preparing to take their revenge. There was a panic about Chinese-run opium dens in all the major cities. The truth was that there were less than 1,000 Chinese in Britain at that time. But the hysteria ran out of control. It was called the Yellow Peril. The panic also spread through America, especially the West Coast, where there were Chinese migrant workers. Novel after novel was published in both Britain and America with Chinese villains who were trying to destroy Western civilization. It culminated with the invention of a global villain, Dr. Fu Manchu. Fu Manchu is described by his creator, a novelist called Sax Rohmer, as a yellow Satan, an archangel of evil who wants to take over the whole world and revenge himself on the white race.
The injection of the serum will make his brain mine. In other words, he becomes a reflection of my will. He will do as I command, exactly as though I were doing it.
In the name of the British government, I demand the release of this boy.
British government? I'll wipe them and the whole accursed white race off the face of the earth when I get the sword and mask that will call the teeming millions of Asia to the uprising. This is only the beginning. I will wipe out your whole accursed white race.
This is Radio Free Oz. And now, we return you to Act 3 of the exciting conclusion of this week's mystery, The Poison Puff, with our guest super sleuth, Charlie Chance. In the lovely Victorian greenhouse of the late Dr. Anslinger, Charlie Chance has gathered together all of the possible suspects of this week's heinous crime. As his long, delicate fingers unhook the top frog of his richly embroidered Mandarin kimono due to the excessive humidity, we hear him say...
You may all be wondering why I have gathered you together in the late doctor's lovely Victorian greenhouse at such a late hour. You see, just as I was drifting off to sleep, the elements of this heinous crime suddenly locked themselves together like the pieces of an ancient Chinese puzzle.
I say, Mr. Chance, can't we get this damnable business over with so that we can all go back to our beds?
No one appreciates better than I the lateness of the hour. But you, Mr. Hawthorne Heathcliff, as the sole partner of the late Dr. Anslinger and the co-owner of his vast botanical patents, should be particularly interested in, shall I say, rooting out the culprit.
I don't know what I'm doing here. I got enough on me hands keeping Mulch Manor clean.
And who but you, Nurse Warren, as the lifelong companion and trusted confidant of the murdered man, would know better the hidden nooks and crannies of this ill-fated domicile.
Right you are, Chance. I've never liked that woman, and I've always suspected that all she wanted was the doctor's money.
Why, Mr. Mossback?
Mr. Mossback, you would do well to remember the old Chinese proverb, he who works in glass greenhouse should not get stoned. Is it not common knowledge that as the doctor's botanical assistant for 14 years, you were jealous of his position and honors and disappointed by your lack of achievement?
Oh, Harry, I know you didn't do it. Why, we were to be married in this very greenhouse.
I sympathize with your concern for the doctor's assistant, Harry Mossback, niece Wendy Simmons. But is it not true that just before the unfortunate doctor's life was snuffed out, he was in the process of rewriting his will that would have cut you off without a farthing had you married his assistant?
The doctor and I were discussing a more fitting match for the lovely Miss Wendy.
Oh.
Hawthorne Heathcliff, you bounder?
Gentlemen, gentlemen, let us review the facts. On the night of October 7th...
Eight.
Thank you, number one, son. In this greenhouse, Dr. Anslinger was deeply absorbed in completing the final experiments on what was to be the most significant of his many botanical achievements. The first successful transplanting above the Tropic of Cancer of the virtually extinct herb Argentum Cannibal Vulgaris, or Glistening Javanese Bogfink, the one known cure for asthma.
Oh, the poor man, he suffered from it all his life.
He suffers no more.
Oh.
Because late last night, while the doctor was in a remote corner of the greenhouse watering his rare orchids organically, one of you snuck in here, crept over to the doctor's work table, opened the golden cigarette case in which the doctor kept his daily supply of Asmador cigarettes, his sole relief from the racking pains of asthma, and replaced the contents with cigarettes of their own making. They did not contain asmidor. Oh, no. But poison oak. The doctor returned to his work table, lit one of the counterfeit cigarettes, treated himself to a long, poisoned puff, hallucinated briefly, and died of the fantastic complications.
Why, only a monster would do that.
Yes, indeed. Only a monster. The doctor returned to his work table, lit one of the counterfeit cigarettes, treated himself to a long, poisoned puff, hallucinated briefly, and died of the fantastic complications.
Why, only a monster would do that.
Yes, indeed. Only a monster. And a very clever monster at that. And now, my friends, I am going to place the finger of justice on that monster.
Can Charlie Chan unravel the incredibly knotted web of this insidious, not to say heinous, crime?
I told you not to say that.
With the only few meager clues at his command, as he steps forward, his long, delicate fingers unhooking the second frog of his richly embroidered Mandarin kimono, we hear him say...
Finger. Unbeknownst to all of you, I visited your separate bedrooms this evening and extracted scrapings from beneath your fingernails. From beneath your fingernails, Mr. Hawthorne Heathcliff, I recovered these scrapings. They look remarkably like Asmodor, do they not?
No, they're nothing of the sort.
Exactly so. By quick chemical analysis, I've determined them to be a common oriental drug. You are not the murderer, Mr. Hawthorne Heathcliff, but you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Your fingernails yielded nothing, Nurse Warren.
Oh, I should think not. I ain't got no fingernails.
But I could not help but notice that your fingers were entirely covered with blisters, similar to those produced by poison oak.
Oh, that's from all the scrubbing of the pots and pans in Bloody Mulch Manor.
Of course. You have no need to fear accusation. What you need is a new detergent. But you, Harry Mossback, I hold in this envelope the scrapings from beneath your fingernails. They are, without a doubt, glistening Javanese bog think.
It's true. I snuck in last night and stole the doctor's prize specimen. I was tired of being an assistant all my life. And anyway, the bog think was mine. Yes, I stole it, but I wouldn't kill the old man. He was like a father to me. As a matter of fact, he was my father.
Then, Harry, that means we can never be married. Oh, it can't be true.
Oh, but it is true. Harry would never have killed his father. And you, Wendy, had nothing to gain. That leaves only...
What are you talking about, Chan? There are no suspects left.
None except Arthur, the butler.
I'm not even in the script. I'm just standing over here with my hands in my pockets watching the whole thing unfold as it was.
With your hands in your pockets.
Hey.
And that's where the elements in this heinous crime suddenly lock together like the pieces of an ancient Chinese puzzle. When I examined the golden cigarette case, I was puzzled by the complete lack of fingerprints. At first, I thought the murderer must have worn gloves. But this is not the season for gloves. And then it came to me. No fingerprints could only mean that the murderer had no hands. Take your hands out of your pockets, Mr. Arthur.
Now, wait a minute. I've got nothing to hide.
Precisely. You have nothing to hide, as everyone can see now, because you have no hands. Inspector Gridley, take him away. The mystery is solved.
And so, unhooking the final frog of his richly embroidered Mandarin kimono and smiling his inscrutable smile, Charlie Chance brings to a close another exciting episode of Who Done Did It. Be with us next week when our guest super sleuth, Sam Spade, tackles the case of the Maltese Chitlin.
But at home, in both Britain and America, there were still forces deep in the heart of both societies that had little to do with democracy.
Man with a gun! 12 Georgia, 30, I need additional units, 6-7 in Dacre. Got a 415 man with a gun. He's running north.
It seemed that despite all the changes of the past 30 years, that underneath the old structures of power and the corruption and the anger that created was still there. In In Los Angeles, in March 1991, Rodney King was chased and stopped by police for drunken driving. Despite offering no resistance, he was beaten repeatedly by four officers.
Hey, Deputy Dan nos ayuda cuando estamos golpeados.
Deputy Dan will knock us down when we're injured by a car. I think is what that is.
It was videoed by a man watching from a balcony. He took it to the police, but no one was interested. So he gave the tape to a local TV station. When it was shown, there was an outburst of anger against the police violence. Four of the officers were put on trial. But they were all acquitted by an overwhelmingly white jury.
Wednesday, I watched a riot. I seen the cops out on the street. Watch them throwing rocks and stuff and choking in the heat. Listen to reports about the whiskey passing round. Seen the smoke and fire and the market burning down. Watch while everybody on your street would take a turn. The stomping, smashing, bashing, crashing, slashing, busting, burn. And I'm watching and I'm waiting, hoping for the best. Even think I go to praying. Every time I hear them saying that there's no way to delay that trouble coming every day. No way to delay that trouble coming every day. Well, you can cool it, you can heat it. Cause baby, I don't need it. Take your TV tube and eat it. And all that phony stuff on sports and all the unconfirmed reports. You know, I watch that rotten box until my head began to hurt. From checking out the way the newsmen say they get the dirt before the guys on channel so-and-so. And further they assert that any show they'll interrupt to bring you news if it comes up. They say that if the place blows up, they will be the first to tell. Cause the boys they got downtown are working hard and doing swell. And if anybody gets the news before it hits the street, they say that no one blabs it faster, their coverage can't be beat. And if another woman driver gets machine gun from a seat, they'll send some joker with a brownie and you'll see it all complete. So I'm watching and I'm waiting, hoping for the best. Even think I go to praying. Every time I hear them saying that there's no way to delay that trouble coming every day. No way to delay that trouble coming every day. Hey, you know something, people? I'm not black, but there's a whole lot of times I wish I could say I'm not white.
And I looked down at my skin, and sure enough, it was white.
White as snow.
White as ice.
White as terror.
Due to the escalation of the situation and seriousness of the problems that are occurring, the sheriff has mobilized all department personnel.
For 6 days, thousands of people rose up and rioted across Los Angeles. It was only stopped when the National Guard and soldiers and Marines were brought onto the streets. It was an outpouring of the anger that had been simmering throughout the 1980s in the black community. Despite all the reforms and the changes in attitudes since the 1960s, nothing had really changed. It seemed that those in power in America were still deeply racist and would use violence against blacks in America to maintain that power.
People gonna survive. Yeah. Now, that's wrong about the black people tearing up the, you know, burning down buildings. That's wrong. But still, through it all, we gonna survive. So, everybody, I'm off.
All right, well, that's just an example of the frustration that's being felt here.
In Britain, a series of scandals revealed that dozens of innocent people had been held in jail, some for over 15 years. They included the Guildford Four and the Birmingham Six. Most of them were Irishmen, who have been accused of being members of the IRA and planting bombs in English cities. Every time they had tried to prove their innocence, they had been blocked by some of the most senior figures in the British establishment, despite overwhelming evidence of false confessions and faked evidence. Eminent men at the very centre of power, from the most senior law lord to the Attorney General and to the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, all of them, it was alleged, knew that the prisoners were innocent. But they had done nothing, and the evidence remained locked away, because they had an unshakable conviction that the establishment must never be shown to be wrong.
Hate cops, Guido. I always hate cops. Yeah, Nick, I hate cops too.
Yeah, me too.
I'll tell you guys what I'm gonna do. I'll tell you what I'm gonna get even with every rotten cop in this city.
Yeah, me too.
How you gonna do it, Nick? How you gonna do
it? You know what I'm gonna do?
No, what you gonna do, Nick?
I'm gonna turn in my badge.
Yeah. I'm gonna burn my uniform.
Finally, in March 1991, the Birmingham Six were freed at the Old Bailey.
Ladies and gentlemen, for 16 and a half years, we have been plagued used as political scapegoats for people in there at the highest. The police told us from the start that they knew we hadn't done it. They told us they didn't care who'd done it. They told us that we were selected and that they were going to frame us just to keep the people in there happy. That's what it's all about. This. Justice. I don't think them people in there have got the intelligence nor the honesty to spell the word. Never mind dispense it. They're rotten.
The door swung open.
Good morning, Mrs. Moriarty.
I fired point blank.
Oh, Mrs. Moriarty, my dear lady, let me help you.
Look at this great V in my chest.
Are you hurt?
Ah, faith and Gomorrah, doctor. By the blood of St. Mencius, I'm from Ireland, and as you're to ducking bullets, as you are to ducking billets.
Oh, well, yes.
And here's last month's.
We'll squeeze out your rent as soon as Fleet Street runs our latest penny dreadful through the press. Don't worry.
I never worry, Mr. Stones, especially when there's a high-heeled foreign lady and her heathen servant waiting for you on the footpad below.
A case at last.
We'll show her up.
I'd be glad to. Mr. Stones, I'll see you now, you cheap whore.
But there were others, also at the heart of power in Britain, who seemed to have lost all contact with reality. The intelligence agencies, from MI6 to GCHQ, whose job was to watch and monitor what was happening in the world, had completely failed to predict the collapse of the Soviet Union. Mrs. Thatcher, who had supported the spies throughout the 1980s, was shocked. Her foreign policy advisor wrote, "All that intelligence that they gave us didn't tell us the one thing we needed to know, that the Soviet Union was about to collapse. It was a colossal failure of the whole Western system of intelligence." But some of the spies still didn't believe what was happening. Sir Percy Craddock was head of the Joint Intelligence Committee. Despite everything, he was convinced the Soviets were just faking the collapse. They were just up to their usual tricks. They were still planning to take over the world. Both Britain and America were societies that had been built on empire and conquest through violence and the exercise of power. But neither of them had ever faced up to this. And instead, they had both built dreamlike myths about their exceptionalism to shield and protect themselves. But in both cases, those myths were rooted in fear. In Britain, at the start of the 20th century, not only were those in charge frightened by what they had done abroad, with the slave trade and in China, but they now had a feeling that it was coming closer. that something dangerous might also be happening inside England itself. The Empire had led to giant industrial cities rising up all across England. They were dark, frightening places where millions of people lived in appalling conditions.
Hello, hello there, dear friends and kids. This is your old Uncle David, and it's time for the Whisper and Squash Show.
Yay! Hooray for the squash!
Yes, sirree, the old Whisper and Squash Show, brought to you again by organic food. Remember, if you're gonna eat it raw.
Hey, Uncle David, pick a familiar story.
Well, let's see, what about The Maiden and the Mouse?
Hey, right on. Pick a method of transportation, Uncle David.
Well, now, what about a dugout?
Too primitive.
Too slow.
Too deep.
Well, all right. What about an atom sled?
Too fast.
Too corny.
Too square.
Well, what about the Silver Gray Angel of Los Angeles?
Yay! Yay!
Okay, kids, climb up in the balloon now.
Okay.
Pick up your oars. Don't forget to feather them at every stroke.
Look at the wine dark air.
Well, gee, Uncle David, which way are we going?
Are we going east?
West?
North?
South?
Southwest?
No, no, no. There's two more directions. China's in the way of one of them. But the other way is clear sailing straight up to Mars.
Hooray!
One more!
Why? Where?
To be in time for the big balloon rabbit roundup and to visit the city of the future. We are flying toward a big American city in the year 2000 AD. The wings of our Zeppelin tilt, and below we see green squares and circles and triangles that look like parks.
Look at those narcs.
Golden threads of roads tie the patches of green together. In the distance, pink and white and yellow skyscrapers sparkle. The air looks as if someone had washed it.
Where's the soap? Where is the smoke?
We ask our guide, Mr. Fuller, and Mr. Fuller laughs.
There isn't any smoke to speak of. Cities got rid of smoke years ago. Few people burn coal for heat anymore. Coal is used for other purposes.
Our Zeppelin lands smoothly on an enormous landing field.
We'll drive downtown. We could take a helicopter, but you'll see more by road. Now, this road over here, this pink one, that's an expressway. When we started to make our cities more comfortable to live in, we built expressways all through it. On the expressways, you can go quickly from the edge of the city to the center, or from one side to the other. And since one expressway never runs directly into another one, we have few traffic accidents.
Gee, what a lot of narcs!
Well, we do have a lot of parks, but those aren't parks. Those are neighborhoods. Look, you can see the houses.
Hey, what is a neighborhood?
It's a group of about 2,000 poor people. These people have their own grade school, churches, all-night drug abusement center, and play fields. Several neighborhoods go together as a clang or community. The community has a high school, a community center, a hospital, and a health bund.
Well, I'm glad I asked.
Listen, where's the free clinic?
Well, you may ask, but we took that away with the old gridiron streets. You see, those lead to dead end and weird children. Now the children can ride themselves safely on neighborhood streets. Now, as we approach the business district, you'll notice those tall apartment buildings over there.
Look at that.
Now, 50 years ago, this was one of the worst slums in the United States. 7,000 people that were falling down were crowded into old houses. Now, 24,000 people live there comfortably. The extra space comes from turning the old streets upside down into parks and laying the tall apartment buildings on their sides.
Look out for that robot!
Oh! Where are the whorehouses?
Well, many of the warehouses live here along the river. City factories aren't allowed to be smoky and noisy, so the whorehouses are out in the country.
As we drive slowly through the streets of the Garden City, we wish we could stay in the year 2000 AD, but Mr. Fuller says we must come back.
Come back.
Now you have seen how cities can look and will look.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Uncle
yes,
David.
America is a land of towns and cities. We should make it a land of beautiful towns and cities. These should be good places for people to play and to live and to work.
Why is he changing
work,
his voice?
Work, work.
What alarmed those in charge was the violence and the anger that was building up there among what was called the masses. But the danger also seemed to come from the top of society as well. From the new industrialists and bankers who ran the global empire. They also seemed to be out of control. There was a wave of financial scandals, and no one seemed to be able to stop them. The novelist E.M. Forster wrote, "England is being menaced by the inner darkness in high places that has come with this commercial age." Trapped by what they saw as a danger below and corruption above, the middle classes retreated. They turned away into another imaginary version of England, where there were none of these threats. It was invented for them by a whole generation of writers, artists, and musicians, who in an act of collective imagination created a complete dream image of England's past. One that still haunts the country today. At its heart was a vision of a natural order in the countryside outside the cities. One of the key figures was a man called Cecil Sharp. He travelled through England recording old songs, and he filmed himself and his friends learning old rural dances. Sharp made it absolutely clear that this was a political project. His aim was to create a new kind of English nationalism, which had at its heart the idea of the folk. It was a concept that he had taken from German nationalism, the innocent rural people and their culture.
Now, it's the sort of dancing he does, the dancing that would have been done around here in
the pubs. Oh, it's done in the pubs.
What was implicit in Sharp's vision was that it was an England before mass democracy had come. An England where villagers lived in harmony and safety, taken care of by the lord of the manor.
Harry, I've never seen a thing like this before in my life. What do you call him?
I call it Dancing Doll.
Sharp was not alone. In 1914, a festival was started in Glastonbury. It ran every year until 1927. It was organised by Rutland Boughton, who wanted it to be the centre of this new English culture. He composed an opera for the festival, which became a national sensation. It was called The Immortal Hour. It is set in a dark, mysterious wood, where there are powerful ancient forces. They can be frightening, but they are also a way of connecting with a forgotten natural order of power in England. They are the lordly ones.
How beautiful they are, the lordly ones, who dwell in the hills, in the hollow. They have faces like flowers, and their breath is the wind that blows over summer meadows filled with dewy clover.
Old woman!
Man!
Ma'am, sorry.
What knight lives in that castle over there?
I'm 37.
What?
I'm 37. I'm not old.
Well, I can't just call you man.
You could say Dennis.
I didn't know you were called Dennis.
Well, you didn't bother to find out, did you?
I did say sorry about the old woman, but from behind you looked...
What I object to is you automatically treat me like an inferior.
Well, I am king.
Oh, king, eh? Very nice. And how'd you get that, eh? By exploiting the workers. By hanging on to outdated imperialist dogma which perpetuates the economic and social differences in our society. If there's ever going to be any progress...
Dennis, there's some lovely filth down here. Oh, how'd you do?
How do you do, good lady? I am Arthur, King of the Britons. Whose castle is that?
King of the who?
The Britons.
Who are the Britons?
Well, we all are. We are all Britons. And I am your king.
I didn't know we had a king. I thought we were an autonomous collective.
You're fooling yourself. We're living in a dictatorship. A self-perpetuating autocracy in which the working classes...
Oh, there you go, bringing class into it again.
Well, that's what it's all about. If only people would...
Please, please, good people. I am in haste. Who lives in that castle?
No one lives there.
Then who is your lord?
We don't have a lord.
What?
I told you, we're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet. I order you to be quiet.
Order? Who does he think he is?
I'm your king.
Well, I didn't vote for you.
You don't vote for kings.
Well, how'd you become king, then?
The Lady of the Lake. Her arm clad in the purest shimmering samite held aloft Excalibur from the bosom of the water, signifying by divine providence that I, Arthur, was to carry Excalibur. That is why I'm your king.
Listen, strange women lying in ponds distributing swords is no basis for a system of government. Supreme executive power derives from a mandate from the masses, not from some farcical aquatic ceremony.
Be quiet!
Oh, but you can't expect to wield supreme executive power just because some watery tart threw a sword at you.
Shut up!
Oh, but if I went round saying I was an emperor just because some moistened bint had lobbed a scimitar at me, they'd put me away.
Shut up! Will you shut up?
Ah, now we see the violence inherent in the system.
Shut up!
Oh, come and see the violence inherent in the system! Help! Help! I'm being repressed!
Bloody peasant!
Oh, what a giveaway. Did you hear that? Did you hear that, eh? That's what I'm on about. Did you see him repressing me? You saw it, didn't you?
This is a story that begins in any part of America, wherever you may be. It's a story that begins at your front door, on the street where you live, in your town or village or city, somewhere in America. And paths enchanted that lead to the wonderful pages of a storybook that tell the story of America the Beautiful.
Unlike Britain, America had emerged from the First World War as the most powerful country in the world. Its president, Woodrow Wilson, had a vision that America should now use that power to spread democracy all around the globe. Behind this was a belief in what was called American exceptionalism, that the country was special, not like the old corrupt empires of Europe, and it could use that specialness to remake the world. But the Republicans who controlled Congress refused to back Wilson. They thought that such a crusade would end up corrupting America. And Wilson's dream of a globalized democracy collapsed. Instead, the American economy went into a severe depression. In a growing mood of fear, there were race riots as whites turned on the black communities in the cities.
You have the choice of spending 15 years married to a woman, a black woman or a white woman. 15 years kissing and hugging and sleeping real close on hot nights. 15 years with a black woman or 15 years with a white woman. The white woman is Kate Smith. And the black woman is Lena Horne. So you are not concerned with black or white anymore, are you?
In 1921, a white mob attacked the black areas in the city of Tulsa and destroyed them. They even used aircraft to drop bombs. Out of this fear came an organization called the Ku Klux Klan.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful, Charlie. Speaking as you do to all the chickens out there, you know, Bill Bailey, out on Old Oildale Road.
I was working with chickens.
You were, huh?
I was a cock teaser at Roosterama.
Oh, really?
I used to enrage the bantams before the big bouts.
Yeah, right. That's
not an easy thing. Ask Pedro here.
Yeah, right.
What?
Pedro, you used to work down there, Roosterama.
Yeah, sure, man. You were the best cock.
How did you enrage those little buggers?
I used to sit on them, man.
See, man, that's hard.
I would dress up like a big egg, man, and then I would sit on them, and that freaks them out.
Those chickens are really confused.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, man.
They get mad and angry into the cockpit. What a fight!
Klan. The Klan had first been formed after the American Civil War. But now it re-emerged. The Klan also believed in the idea of America's exceptionalism. But they took that myth and turned it into something frightening and violent. And they used it to protect themselves against the perceived threat of a growing black population. The model for this dark and hateful version came from a feature film made in 1915 called The Birth of a Nation. It was an epic that caused a sensation, reaching a wider audience than any film had ever done. The director, D.W. Griffith, had based the film on a novel called The Klansman. The image of the Klansman in both the book and in the film was of white-robed figures with burning crosses. These had nothing to do with anything real in America's past. Instead, the novelist had invented them from a romantic vision of an old Scotland and Scottish clans that were portrayed in the novels of Sir Walter Scott, which Scott himself had just made up. Again, like in England, it was a vision of a stable society, watched over and protected by benevolent leaders. Figures from a feudal time, a time before mass democracy and all its dangers and uncertainties. In real life, the new Klan then copied the costumes and imitated the rituals from the film. And it quickly became a mass organization. By 1925, the Klan had 5 million members and the political power to mount a mass march on Washington. They called themselves the Invisible Empire. The Klan had a powerful appeal to whites, frightened of the blacks in the ever-expanding cities. And they also revived fears of the Chinese, the Yellow Peril. What the Klansmen were doing was retreating into a mythical version of the past. It gave them a sense of power and of being part of a natural order.
On this particular day, I was just scrolling through all of Craigslist and I saw that there was an ad. The ad just read, "Join the KKK."
Lieutenant, excuse me, sir. Man, what are we going to do, man?
Yeah, man, what are we going to do, man?
Well, we're going to lock and load, Private. Yes, sir. And then we're going to go out there and we're going to...
Kosovo, crucify him, man. I love his war movies.
Yeah, but
yeah, with those swords, man. No, take off a person's head.
Question mark. And so naturally, I was like, dope. And so I started a correspondence with this dude named Dale. And like, I felt kind of bad because like, if you're hurting that bad in 2004 for recruitments that you need a Craigslist ad, then we must be making progress. Like, you know, the world's getting better. And so I talked to Dale a little bit, you know, just emailing back and forth. I was like, hey, what's up? I'm white. You want to chill sometime and talk? And by chill, I don't mean the way black people use chill. I mean actually go somewhere cold and hang out together as friends. And to my surprise, the next day, I had an email from Dale that was like, hey, great to meet you. You seem like a cool guy. And all of our correspondence for the first couple days was like the most basic, just like, oh man, you like Star Wars too? So do I as well. Like I couldn't be natural on the thing. Like I was so nervous every time I type. But then once we really got like a rapport built up, he was like, we should meet. I want you to meet the brothers. And I was like, that sounds great. And I grew up in Alexandria, Louisiana, which if you've never been there, don't know what it is, you're doing fine. So I guess you don't need to. But there's this place, there's this bar called Finnegan's. And I was like, hey, Dale, look, just meet me at Finnegan's and we'll sit down, we'll have a chat and everything. And then if you really like me, you can introduce me and the other brothers and we can all be a family. And so the next day comes, and naturally I don't show up. I don't want to die. I was never going to. That'd be insane. That no. But he hits me up the next day after school. And I should point out that, like, for 2 weeks, I was running home mainly to talk to Dale. I wasn't even reading Craigslist anymore. I had 6 friends, and Dale was one of my best ones. But I came home the other day, and he was like, hey, I went to Finnegan's, and I waited on you, and you didn't come, man. Why would you stand me up like that? And I was like, oh, dude, I'm so sorry. And so I came up with an excuse, and this is like, you know, we're talking 2004. We're talking before, like, everybody had a cell phone, you know? So it's like some people still, you know, didn't have a cell phone, and they made plans, and they went out, and they did them, you know? And so if there was a hiccup, you just had to roll with it because you couldn't just text someone like, hey, I'm totally not going to abide by the plan now. I've chosen a different plan. I'm letting you know now. So for a week, I just like kept getting Dale to eat and shop alone. Like... And each time I had a great excuse. Like each time I was like, oh, my mom fell and like I just had to be there with her and everything. And every day he understood and he was like, you know what? You did the right thing, brother, you know? And I remember one day especially he was particularly upset because he had come home, obviously come home, emailed me that evening, but I didn't see it till the next day. And he was like, you never came to Target. I was in Target by myself for 3 hours. I bought a popcorn maker. I don't even need a popcorn maker. I was just in Target by myself and bored. And I was waiting on you. Now I got a popcorn maker in front of me. And what are you going to do about this popcorn maker? And I was like, bruh, I'm so sorry. And by bruh, I do mean shorthand for brother, not the way that black people use it. I'm so sorry. I just... you know, my girlfriend, she tripped. It was always women falling. Like, I'm surprised that he never caught on. Every time it was like, oh, yeah, my great aunt just hit a stair. Or, like just the worst lies. I was a 14-year-old idiot. And even now, I'm like, wow, like, I was alone with a computer, and I just catfished the Klan.
And in Britain, the belief in the idea of a natural order of power continued to grow, even as the real power was declining. And this deluded confidence was going to have very strange consequences for the whole world. After the First World War, a group of upper-class English men and women were sent to Baghdad to create a new country out of the ruins of what had been the Ottoman Empire. The most famous was Gertrude Bell. She was the daughter of a baronet and had been a famous explorer. Almost immediately, hundreds of thousands of Arabs rose up, demanding independence. The British had been financially broken by the war, so they invented a new and cheap way of suppressing the insurgency. They used aircraft to bomb the rebels. They called it aerial policing. And they took back control and set about creating the new country called Iraq. But because there was no money, the group could also not afford to survey the country. Instead, with no information, Bell and the others simply projected onto the Arabs that powerful romantic dream of an old England. They decided that the middle classes in the cities who had run the country under the Ottoman Empire were corrupt and untrustworthy, which meant that they had to be excluded from power. Instead, power should be given to the sheikhs, who ruled the tribes out in the countryside. To the British, the sheikhs represented the true Iraq, because they hadn't been infected by the corruption of the modern world. Their system was one of a natural order, just like in the England of the past. The sheikhs, said Gertrude Bell, are like great aristocrats. They will run a system that will maintain a natural equilibrium. The truth was that this picture of Iraq was completely detached from reality. The sheikhs were really marginal figures. While the Ottomans had begun to create a modern, progressive society in the cities, the British now tore that apart and replaced it with a strange dream that had nothing to do with the complex, multi-layered society in front of their eyes, but was really rooted in the strange, dark fears that were rising up in Britain itself as its power declined. Then, in 1932, the British, facing an economic crisis at home, packed up and went, leaving behind them a completely unreal and unstable society.